From the University of Oregon's Agora Journalism Center, this is the Listener's Podcast. Welcome back to Oregon Speaks, Voices from This Moment, a special season of the Listener's Podcast produced by the graduate students at the University of Oregon. I'm Andrew Devigal, the director of the Agora Journalism Center and a professor at U of O's School of Journalism and Communication. In this season, we're exploring how Oregonians are navigating this moment of transition through stories of uncertainty, mutual aid, resilience, and care. Let's listen in.
This is Kristen Miko with the University of Oregon. The Trump administration's cuts during his first 100 days upended how we get food to people and how small and mid-sized farms can stay in business. One of the programs on the chopping block? The COVID-era program that put money in farmers' hands for seeds, equipment, and infrastructure. It also helped food pantries and school meal programs buy from local farms, ensuring access to healthy food for recipients of programs like SNAP and Medicaid. These cuts amounted to $1 billion in funding to localize food systems. Meanwhile, Trump created an $11 billion subsidy to Big Ag, our country's biggest commodity crop producers. And here's the real impact. Access to fresh, healthy food isn't just about hunger. It affects our environment, our communities, and even, wait for it, the healthcare system. So yes, it's a crisis, but it's also an opportunity. Today, we'll look at food system models that are stepping up and rebuilding just as the old system crumbles. Central to these systems are a vision for true food security, which, as COVID taught us, we don't really have. You'll hear from two people leading the charge. First, we'll talk to Fiona Keneally, Systems Data and Impact Specialist at Lift Up, a food assistance program in Portland, Oregon. Her program is in the midst of pivoting models while solving immediate food needs. Next, we talk to Shelley Schuler, founder of Lane County Bounty, a thriving food hub serving traditional markets and food assistance programs. I sat down with Fiona to get the conversation started.
Yeah, okay, you've got some notes.
Yeah,
I've got some notes. We're both a little nervous. So I wanted to start, how had the local food program from the federal government, how had that impacted your program? Like, what was its role, and how long had you anticipated that program lasting?
This was a program that we had come to rely on kind of indefinitely. It's a pretty substantial part of the Oregon Food Bank's incoming food. So it's about 18% of their total food, and it's mostly the fresh stuff. So produce, dairy, eggs, meat, which is a big part of what we rely on the Oregon Food Bank for, is bringing those fresh goods in. Yeah, and the funds that are being cut specifically, one portion of them are USDA agricultural subsidies. So these are foods that are grown kind of on a large scale and then reallocated through the Feeding America network to food banks across the nation. And then another part of the funding that's frozen right now is a local food purchasing program that allows the Oregon Food Bank to direct purchase from farms. So the loss of those funds is hurting us on the food banking side because we're without a resource we've come to rely on. And it's also hurting these small to mid-sized farms that have come to rely on the Oregon Food Bank as a purchaser. So these cuts, we got the notification for these cuts in March of 2025. The first couple of months we're supposed to be seeing on the ground in June. And we have started to see some reductions in the food that's available through the food bank, but we're not sure the exact scope. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now about what this will look like on the ground. But we do know that there's likely to be less food. And at the same time, the cuts and threats to benefits like SNAP, Social Security, disability benefits are creating a pressure from our community on the other end.
The Trump administration's Big Beautiful Bill is likely to make good on those threats, proposing $1 billion in funding cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP, and school programs. The pressure is only mounting.
If we're looking at historical data, we actually saw a decrease in pantry visits during the couple of first years of the pandemic, because that influx of resources helped kind of keep people afloat. And in the years following, those benefits and those resources started to slowly dry up, and we saw an immediate spike in pantry visitors. That fiscal year, half of all visitors to our pantry were first-time visitors.
When extra pandemic benefits ended, it hit families already living on the edge, and local agencies felt the strain. Since then, demand for services has grown 20 to 30% each year. That's across the board, and it's not sustainable. By fall 2023, local nonprofits came together in response. They all saw the same crisis: skyrocketing need and shrinking resources.
So what started as kind of an informal conversation among these partners is becoming a small coalition, the Coalition to Advance Food Equity. It's a group of 9 pantry and gleaning organizations centered with some kind of service based in Northwest and downtown Portland. And our thinking behind coming together in that way is kind of, we are losing the resources that we've come to rely on, and the people we serve are facing cuts that are impacting their ability to get enough food on the table. Our solutions are not going to come from out there somewhere. They're likely not going to come from government, not going to come from somewhere on high. And so we saw the need to work together and really increase our collaboration. And then also in a political sense, there hasn't been a voice advocating for food security at the city or county level in over a decade. There's a need for that kind of legislative push right now. And also just the environment of everybody is burned out, everybody is at the edge of capacity, and that's where we've been sitting for several years now.
Just given everything that you just described, what does it look like for the people that you serve, like really from the ground level now?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We at Lift Up run kind of 2 programs. We have our public food pantry, and then we have our Adopt a Building program, which is provides on-site food security services to affordable housing communities. And we're having to have conversations on the delivery side, on the Adopt a Building side, about what service reductions would look like if we had to implement them. And so we're having conversations with recipients of this service, with housing partners, with people who are funding the service. And we haven't had to make drastic changes yet, but we're setting the stage and trying to keep people really informed about what's coming down the line.
What is that like for you and the people that you work with? Like, it's obviously stressful for people that are looking for food. It's stressful for farmers that have had this market drop from under them. And what is it like for people like you who are on the forefront of this?
I can't deny the stress of it. And I feel really fortunate because the team, the staff, the volunteers, everyone working on the ground at Lift Up is incredibly, we are a scrappy, very resilient, very dedicated bunch. And so I think that's part of why we're seeing this as a breakdown and also an opportunity. And I'm not denying any of the grief or the hurt or the hardship that this is causing. And I think a lot of what's falling apart right now are systems that were fragile to begin with. And so as hard as it is to see like these big singular sources of food that we've relied on go away, it opens the door to building a food system that's less reliant on single sources and to sourcing in ways that are more economically beneficial to our local farmers, to our local people. Some of these issues feel like inevitabilities of a fragile system. I think that the funding freeze is unveiling a lot of that and accelerating a lot of that. So instead of moving in the direction of a more local and more diverse food stream, we are needing to do that right now. We're needing to do that yesterday.
Fortunately for Fiona, people like Shelley Schuler have been laying down the groundwork for new systems. She and Fiona share the vision for a sustainable food system, but Shelley comes to the conversation from the farming perspective. As much as food assistance programs need diversified food sources, aggregated and accessible to the community, Small to mid-sized farms need a new system just as badly. Enter the food hubbing model.
People are confused about what food hubs are often, and there's a lot of businesses of lots of different sizes that are distributing food. There's food distributors that buy from local farms and sell to cafeterias or to restaurants. But a food hub has a different value within the supply chain, because the value is not to increase the profit margin of that particular aggregator. Like, we exist to move food around as cheaply as possible so that the end price is as accessible as it can be, and we are able to buy as much as possible from farms.
Food hubs have always been a solution to food insecurity.
Food hubs are about access. Small farms need to stay strong because when supply chains break down, local food systems are what keep shelves stocked. And that resilience isn't just for a crisis. It needs to exist all the time.
COVID-19 pandemic absolutely brought a lot of new food hubs into play. And that's when ours started. We started Lane County Bounty in April 2020. Grocery stores were being emptied out regularly, and there's a lot of disruptions in the supply chain. So it was a pretty obvious solution that was needed right then.
Okay, April 2020, that was how many weeks after it broke out? Like, you just sprung.
I was ready. I had been looking at food hubs for a while, and I had made a business plan for one. I had probably taken the first couple of steps, which included a lot of research on web platforms and looking into the software that we would need. I knew how to do it, but I had decided not to. Yeah, there just wasn't enough backing at that point in time. So I was like, okay, it's not right now. Like, I just need to focus on growing food, farming. In 2020, it just quickly became apparent that that was what I needed to do in response to the pandemic. I wanted to keep the connection between farms and consumers, our customers, you know, going. Sometimes it's easy to talk about customers as consumers, but when it comes down to it, they're really, really important, integral part of farming. So they're community members.
CSAs, community-supported agriculture, let people buy directly from farms. But as demand shifted toward more choice and convenience, interest dropped. Food hubs fill that gap. They serve both farms and communities, keeping local food systems alive.
So what we want to do is supplement people's ability to buy food directly from farms, and we'll always encourage people to go straight to the farm. That's such a connecting thing to do and really increases people's understanding and awareness of farms. And it's part of our social networks. It's very important. But the number of people that can go to a farmer's market on a given day during the open hours is pretty limited. So we serve people who need home delivery for a lot of different reasons. I think a really interesting question is, how can food hubs provide services to food banks? And how can we integrate farms into a cooperative system as opposed to competing on a small scale? What food hubs can do is work on the farm side with sourcing and procurement, even getting into forward contracting and purchasing on a larger scale within multiple smaller mid-sized farms. And when we do that kind of coordination, we can actually negotiate better prices for the end customer.
Do you envision a system that's entirely independent from federal money?
Not ideally, no. I think the government should be making food systems more equitable and just. We shouldn't be relying purely on market systems. We do need governmental support to ensure that farms can stay in business and that people can access it. But without it, we can do what food hubs do really well, which is pivot. and be creative. I think healthy systems replicate themselves. And I've been really lucky to be part of a current reorganization of food systems.
While the rest of us cringe at food prices and panic at the threat of not being able to nourish our families or worry about losing local food economies, as community leaders are responding and things are falling apart, it's actually giving life to new ways of being. Emergent strategies are finding places to replicate. Fiona at Lift Up in Portland is tapping into it.
Yeah, this is the joyful part. So a couple of years ago, Lift Up started partnering with our first farm, and they're a newly incorporated small nonprofit grow-to-donate farm. They grow 100% organic produce and donate it to us. And because of our relationships in the community and the network of other food pantries and distributors, we already kind of act as a food hub. We have a big warehouse. We take a lot of, we can take big orders of food in or big drops from the farm. And then we have other agencies that pick up during the week, whether that's because they have less storage space or they just don't have the capacity to have the direct relationships with the farm on the ground. That's one of our kind of operational foundations for the moment that we're in right now. And then the coalition work that we're doing has kind of two branches. There's an operational branch, like we're all seeing this drastic service growth and we're under-resourced. And so we've started doing more collaboration, food sharing, sharing volunteers, coordinating amongst each other, even like identifying the need for more staffing, more vans, like all of the on-the-ground stuff. And then the other side of that is we've started building relationships in local government and with people who could have like legislative impact.
You're describing this beautiful network.
Yes. This is my world. This is what I'm so excited about. Like personally, this is the thing that brings me joy.
Well, do you want to just talk about that for a minute? Like, tell me about the joy that you're finding in this moment.
Yeah, it's a strange thing to talk about joy in a moment when things are falling apart and there's a lot of hurt. I care a lot about food because it's in the middle of so many of the things that I care about. And it's a connector. So like the environmental issues that I care about are deeply tied to the ways that we practice agriculture. And the human health issues that I care about are tied to the way that we nourish ourselves and each other. And the community building aspect, Lift Up's tagline is food brings us together. And one of the things that we've heard from people in the buildings we serve is that they feel safer and they feel more connected to their neighbors because of food programming. So it's this whole nexus of social determinants of health and physical health and environmental health. And it's a place where all of these broken systems coalesce, but it's also a place where when we're building better systems, we have a chance to make change in a lot of different areas at once. And that is really exciting to me.
Can you describe what you think a sustainable food system looks like and what the economic benefit would be to having that type of system?
Yeah, I think a resilient or a sustainable food system is one. It requires us to step outside of looking at food security as an individual person's problem of like, how do we get food on this person's table today? That's one piece of food security. But when we start thinking about food security systemically and as a region, that looks like making sure our farmers are well-resourced, making sure that anybody who needs food has access to food that is nutritious and culturally specific and familiar to them. And it means being attentive to the environmental impacts of the food that we grow. A model that allows us to tick all of these boxes at once is the most beneficial to each of the stakeholders, like to the food bank, to the farmer, to the healthcare entities. And it's also the most beneficial to the people on the ground who are experiencing food insecurity.
So you're seeing this as an opportunity for a much needed change. And as you're pivoting, what are the main questions that you're trying to answer for food security in Portland?
I think in light of the USDA cuts, we're looking at a resource shortage. So it's food and funds are the things that we and all of our partners are needing right now. We're in a position where the federal government is making these cuts. The state government is in a very tight budget year. Local governments are in a very tight budget year. And so we're looking to where could these funds come from and where could the food come from to help fill this gap. And around the time of recording, we're launching a pilot program called Grow to Donate, which is a way to engage our community very directly in helping fill the food gap. And this is a very new pilot, but it's something we're launching with our coalition partners as a way to encourage local folks who have extra food in their backyards or who could grow an extra row of tomatoes to come together and take that extra food and get it to us. And we act as like a distributor node and we'll help get it to all the people in our coalition. And that doesn't cost us anything. And ideally, we would be able to do something similar on a larger scale. I think from our end, from the distributor side, what's needed is an influx of funds to support farmers to grow food. On the farm side, it would be helpful to have someone who acts like Shelley, like an aggregator, and can help bring many different farms' products together to a single source. And then we can play kind of a mirrored role on the distributor side and bring that single source aggregated product and redistribute it out to our network. So that would be the goal. The question becomes, who or what entity could provide the funding and the administrative support to help us build a more resilient, localized, regenerative food system? And that's the million-dollar question.
Shelley secured ample funding from a source with a big interest in access to fresh and local food. The collaborative models emerging are offering equally big solutions.
You recently pivoted to a new funding source. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about the challenges that made you look to healthcare and what your stated objective was in those grants.
Well, those kind of fell in my lap.
Like, realize that investing in people's access to produce improves their healthcare outcomes, and there's data to support that. From the healthcare perspective, it is a good investment to give people what they're calling medically tailored meals or Veggie RX. And by providing people with fresh food, they're seeing improved health outcomes. It's a better economic choice to give people fresh food before they get sick than to need to treat them after they've gotten sick. We've actually had to stop making the case that that's true. It's established. The logistics of getting people that fresh, healthy food is a gap. And that's where we stepped in.
You developed this more of a response to market needs. Mm-hmm. Selling to people that were already trying to buy mm-hmm. local food. So how has the model been able to expand and now serve this whole other group of people?
Oh, yeah. So we are partnering with a health clinic in a rural town of Cottage Grove. And through partnerships with healthcare organizations, we've built the Community Harvest Program. We partner with health clinic who refers us to people who are either experiencing diet-related illness or have the potential to. And we provide those people with subscription to local food grocery box, which includes produce, but also meat, grains, cheese. And through that process, they have the option to swap out items that they don't like. So it provides that autonomy of choice. What we want to do is give people the same experience that one of our retail customers would receive. Everybody deserves nutritious food. Everybody deserves to be nourished and eat fresh food. I think that people should get the good stuff. You know, we want to give people produce when it's at its peak quality.
which is also when it's most nutritious and least likely to be wasted. So the network of farmers that we've developed, through which we aggregate food, people are able to purchase through our local marketplace. It's a robust channel in which food is moving from lots of different places to lots of different tables. And so it means that people who wouldn't normally eat local are able to access the same quality of food that farmers market customers do. And the feedback that we're getting about that program is that people are thrilled. People are so excited.
What do you think the potential is for Fiona at Lift Up to be able to incorporate this model?
Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about the best format for food hubbing. Is it nonprofit? Is it cooperative? Is it for-profit? And there's a lot of different examples of that. I think that there's a lot of magic to be found in the partnership between nonprofits and for-profit or cooperative businesses. Ultimately, what we're doing is buying and selling food. And when nonprofit groups or groups that are specifically missioned to reduce hunger, it's a little bit outside of scope. So I think that farm cooperatives are a really important part of the puzzle because nobody should be doing it all. And if nonprofits can partner with farm co-ops or aggregators that are specifically trying to keep them in business, we can really strengthen what we're doing on a larger scale.
Shelley is advocating on behalf of small and mid-sized farms in order to protect farmer livelihoods, sustain community access to fresh food, and steward best environmental practices. But is there a benefit on the food program side to having large-scale farms produce shelf-stable commodities? Think government cheese. What are the benefits to this model?
Yeah, I think this is where we get into what I was talking about, these cuts being an accelerant to something that was always kind of inevitable, is we're working within an imperfect system. And when I joined Lift Up and came to the food security world, I had a lot of kind of naive idealism. And I was like, I want the food system to look this one particular way, and it could be so beautiful, it could be all of these things. And then doing the work on the ground and seeing sometimes, like you're saying, it's these shelf-stable commodities that are maybe not of a quality that I would want to feed myself, but we're still feeding other people. And balancing those kind of imperfections or places where I see problems with the fact that people need to eat today, and that's the best that we can do. It was putting food on the table, which is what a lot of people, where food security begins and ends for a lot of people. But what we at Lift Up believe, what I personally believe, is that food security is a lot broader than that, true food security. And it doesn't just mean having enough calories to get through the day. It means having enough food to get through the day and having food that is nutritious and familiar, having the resources to prepare the foods that you are accessing, having the dignity of choice in the foods that you are accessing. It's all of these pieces. I think those big subsidized, kind of mass-produced commodity foods were ticking one of the boxes, one of the food security boxes, but they weren't truly moving us in the direction of that holistic food security that is kind of our vision.
Creating food security has long been a bipartisan issue until recently. Now, priorities are shifting, political landscape is being reshaped, and political lines are being redefined.
How is it not a Republican talking point? We're talking about less government, more localized systems.
Because poor people are the beneficiary of these programs. And I think generally the thought is, we're not responsible for feeding you. So again, it's a values difference. Do you think that food is a fundamental human right, or don't you? I think at a point, the economic argument of we don't want to spend money on feeding school children, or it's, you know, not the government's job to feed people. People should be working. They should have jobs. It's so tone deaf to the actual experiences people are having within communities. And I think that they're actually so committed to that argument of not being responsible for feeding people that they're willing to overlook the actual economic benefit of what happens when you do ensure that people have access to food. So it's illogical. And I think it's cruel.
I posed a similar question to Fiona.
What is the mindset? What's the agenda for the Trump administration to not support these types of models? What's the logic?
I don't know. I don't think there is logic behind it. Yeah, I think it has to go back to a misalignment of values, because if your values are the things that I've mentioned, like human health, environmental health, economic prosperity for the small regions and the people on the ground, if those are your working values, this is the model that uplifts those values and works on all ends. I think something that we're seeing in this moment is that solving problems separately is the least efficient way to solve problems.
Community networks need to step in, which is probably something that's been needed this whole time, is local solutions to food insecurity, because everybody needs to eat.
And why did you start caring about food systems?
Me personally?
Mm-hmm.
I grew up very connected to where my food comes from, and I feel extremely fortunate for that. And that to me should not be exceptional. That connection to really nutritious food and the knowledge of where your food comes from and the way of producing food that is respectful to the land and to the people who are participating. That to me is like the baseline. That's not an exception. That's not a gold star. I mean, it's great, but it shouldn't be special in the way that it is. And the older that I've gotten, the more my personal philosophy has been influenced by this kind of grief of our perceived separateness as human beings from the rest of the living world. That's really central to my personal kind of philosophy and guiding ethic. And food is a place where that really, really happens in this country, where a lot of people are not connected to where their food comes from, even just because of like cost or access, or not able to make choices about the food that they're eating. Because it's so central in so many ways, is one of those perfect places. It's an opportunity for starting to heal that relationship between ourselves and the rest of the living world, by supporting, you know, regenerative ways of growing food, and by supporting these little local interconnected food webs and things like that. So I think personally it's like almost a spiritual thing. Like this is really central to an ethic that makes up kind of the core of who I am and what I care about. And getting to see little pilots in Oregon or across the country where food systems are changing in this direction that feels really community-based and really rooted in kind of a stewardship philosophy of like, we are all bound to the economic system that we live in. We can't deny that. But it's less about mass production of a product to sell and make the most profit, and it's more about stewarding the land and the community connections and the things that nourish us, like literally make up every cell in our body.
Yeah, I'm also from a small town, and it gives you this opportunity to see community really working and just all of the interconnections. And there's so much opportunity to have a direct impact because it's such a small scale. How do you see it working in cities? You know, is it scalable?
Yeah, I think something like this in my mind is scalable, but only if you don't lose that human to human connection on the ground. So when I envision any kind of system like what we're talking about, any kind of network system, I don't see it as like one big hub in the middle and lots of little, you know, spokes going out. It's more like a root system or a mycorrhizal network or something where it's like we are a small enough agency at LiftUp that we know the people personally that we're interacting with a lot of the time that we're giving food to. This is especially true for our program staff who are like on the ground. So you have a bunch of these little kind of interpersonal nodes that are very small scale, and then building the connections between those into these larger networks, and then building the connections between those. So I think that kind of spirit of helping each other and having the direct human connection, I think when you lose that, you lose a lot. And so ideally, even a large scale network that has broad geographic reach and is moving a lot of food on the ground, it looks the same. It looks like community members working together.
I can see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I see it.
Thank you so much for listening in. This is Kristen Miko with the University of Oregon, speaking with Fiona Keneally from LiftUp and Shelley Schuler from Lane County Bounty. Please be sure to look below for more information and links to these incredible women doing incredible work to feed us all.
That's it for this episode of the Listener's Podcast, Oregon Speaks. Thanks so much for listening and for making space for these voices. This season of Listeners is produced by graduate students in the Community Voices course at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. If you appreciated what you heard, we'd love for you to share it with someone in your own community. And if this kind of community-based storytelling speaks to you, if you're curious about how to create podcasts that builds trust and sparks dialogue, we've got something for you. The University of Oregon now offers a community podcasting micro-credential, a flexible, hands-on program designed for anyone looking to amplify local voices through audio storytelling. Whether you're new to podcasting or looking to take your work further, this might be the next step. You can learn more about this program with a link in our show notes. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, keep on listening.